I'm Bob Franklin. Thanks very much for joining me. This is Like It Is. Today, my encore interview with the late John Conyers, the congressman who represented Detroit's 1st Congressional District. Our conversation took place in Washington, D.C., and covered a broad range of political topics, including jazz. Welcome to the program, Congressman.
Great to be with you.
Thank you. According to a New York Times CBS poll, President Bush enjoys a 56% approval rating from African Americans. He's the most popular Republican president among blacks since Dwight Eisenhower. What do you attribute this high approval rating to?
Well, because he's, first of all, not hostile to black Americans as Ronald Reagan was, as Richard Nixon was. And so he appears to be likable, and he says a lot of things that are favorable to the African-American community. He appears at a lot of events and functions. But, of course, his conduct does not match his rhetoric. And so a lot of people are flattered by that. I was talking to a lady in Detroit who had been invited to the White House as a Republican to come and visit the White House and tour Washington. And of course, she showed me the letter and she said, I'm not a Republican, but I think it's a great idea that a president would invite me to come to Washington. I might even go.
As a member of the Congressional Black Caucus, what are a few of the items on the caucus's agenda?
Well, that could take up the entire show because we're here deep in the struggle for justice, economic development, for restoring a number of social programs that have been reduced over the last decade by the Reagan administration, and about restoring the civil rights agenda to some prominence in our national delivery of new legislation. So we're working, the 24 members of the Congressional Black Caucus are working very steadily to make sure that the laws, the programs, the policies, the foreign policy, the budget, considerations that we consider to be important are dealt with. And that, of course, gives us a very, very full agenda because we're working on nearly every front.
The Civil Rights Act of 1990, sponsored by Senator Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts and Representative Augustus Hawkins of California, aims to undo 5 major Supreme Court decisions that rolled back anti-discrimination laws. Would you please elaborate on the necessity of the Civil Rights Act?
Well, this proposal is a very meaningful indication of what's wrong with President George Bush and his administration. Because at the present moment, he has been told by the Attorney General, Richard Thornburgh, to veto this bill, which is a reaction to the conservative Supreme Court that Ronald Reagan appointed. So what we're trying to do is repair things that have broken down under the Republican administration, and we're still running into problems. The Civil Rights Act of 1990 attempts to take care of several unbelievable decisions of the Supreme Court that were very hostile, very negative, and lets us know that racism isn't just something that Klansmen and people with hoods take part in the night somewhere in terrorizing people, but that it can be done very subtly by very delicately altering the laws. We've got a Supreme Court decision that we're reversing, which said that it's true that in job security, there can be no discrimination in hiring. But they said, once you get hired, there is no civil right that you should not be harassed or promoted fairly. That's different. What we do is reverse that Supreme Court decision and take it back to the state of law that it was in the beginning, namely that your civil rights to non-racially discriminatory treatment occurs not only when you're hired, but it occurs while you're on the job. It's almost irrational to think that you would lose your civil right once you got inside the door and couldn't get promoted, could get harassed, could be discriminated against. And these eight men and one lady would be able to say, well, that's different. That's a different situation, and we don't want it to cover that. One case that this Reagan court came down with said that the burden of proof in an employment discrimination case should really be on the employee to prove that the employer was discriminating. When the present law up until that decision was that the plaintiff has the burden of proof that the employee, but after he makes a prima facie case, the burden shifts to the employer. And they're saying, well, no, we're going to make it tough on the employee, that they've got to show that there was an intent on the part of the employer to discriminate. Well, most of us have an idea of how hard it is to prove what was going on in somebody's head or heart at the time they did something. Actually, what counts is what is the result. And so we changed that case. We have another situation in which court-approved affirmative action plans would be allowed to be attacked after the case was over, when white employees could come in and charge reverse discrimination after the case was resolved. Now, that makes no sense at all, since all charges, issues, motions have to be brought while the case is going on. But they said, no, even though this group of white employees didn't take part in the case while it was going on and it was ruled against them, we're going to allow them to come back in and reopen the case. The result is that every affirmative action job case could be reopened by any group of disgruntled employees that would bring an action. Now, obviously, that case cannot be allowed to stand. We had another case that just started the time running of when a seniority system that was discriminatory would have it counted against them, and they took the position that was least beneficial to the discriminated against worker. So these are the kinds of small but pernicious things that are being corrected in the Civil Rights Act of 1990. President Bush is still against this. Now, as soon as those people who think that George Bush is such a fine fellow and are registering in the black community that they like Bush, although you may remember that they didn't vote for Bush, then, of course, his popularity is going to begin to turn back down to about where most Republican presidents' policies are. Now, there's another a very huge Supreme Court case that, to me, was so blatantly discriminatory against black businessmen that it needs discussion at this point. It was called Richmond and Croson, in which the Supreme Court set aside programs for business people of color where they hadn't had a chance to participate, because they said that no matter how much discrimination may have gone forward, you've got to prove two new things now. Well, what are they? Well, first of all, you've got to prove that discrimination existed in the city or the state that's bringing the program. Well, you say, well, why would you have to prove it when less than 1% of the programs were going to black businessmen in Richmond who had a population of 80% of the city? They said, well, we don't want to assume anything. That wasn't proven. Well, actually, everybody stipulated to it. It was so obvious. Then they said, well, there's something else, too, that you've got to start proving. What is that? Well, you've got to prove that the businessmen who are going to get the benefit of a set-aside program have got to show that they were discriminated against. That is, that they had tried to get program, a business, and they couldn't get it, and now they're coming under the program to get it. In other words, if you had never tried, then you may not be eligible for the program, because how do we know if you would have gotten some business or not? Well, it wouldn't make sense for people who know that there's discrimination going on to routinely just come up and try to get the business anyway when they know that there's none to be had. Historically, there was none. And so they're saying, well, you didn't try. So you haven't been discriminated against. Unless you've actually been discriminated against, we don't see why you should get the benefit of the program. Now, these things are, this kind of specious reasoning is anti-black on its face. And it's being done by our best legal minds on the highest court in the land. And that's why Reagan appointed them, because they were ideologically driven people who would go through the fine print and try to undo some of the very hard-fought gains that we've made in terms of Supreme Court decision and in set-aside programs and civil rights in America. And this is what the problem is. This is a very serious challenge. It's demoralizing many African Americans, some of whom are feeling that there's no hope in the political process and are turning away from the hard-fought franchise to vote. Here we just turned the corner in American history where black people can cast a ballot. In many places, they still aren't seriously able to run for office, but they're now moving away from the system because they don't realize that's precisely what these negative programs, rulings, and decisions intend to do, is to discourage you, to turn you off, and to get you moving away from participation as opposed to being one that makes a decision.
You represent the first district in Detroit, the automotive capital of America. What impact will the Clean Air Act have on the way cars are manufactured there?
In a larger sense, in this kind of question, we have got an ecological problem, not only in the United States, but in the world. Our garbage is filling up. We can't find enough places to dump it. We now are creating so many plastics and byproducts of military weapons, nuclear bombs, and material that is fissionable, so that we are now faced with an incredible problem of how to deal with all the waste. We have barges in the waters up in the New York, Philadelphia area that are just carrying waste material. They're producing thousands of tons of waste every week, for which there is no place to put them. We have ozone layer, which is now heating up the planet. We have, even in Eastern Europe, we find that Czechoslovakia, East Germany, and other nearby countries have some of the worst pollution, industrial pollution, of anywhere in the world. We've caught American dumpers of garbage contracting with poor third world nations to take some of our very dangerous waste materials and dump them over in those countries. So that we have a serious problem. In the United States, we have the problem of the automobile and the truck, motor transportation, clogging the environment in a very serious way. Los Angeles, of course, is almost devastated by the smog and the waste byproducts of our automobile-driven society. And so what we're trying to do now is to begin to dig out from under that. And the way that we've approached this is that, first of all, we have to begin an education program. To do that, we need to really make people aware of the dangers and the harms of many of the kinds of products that create waste. We also have to take a new look at our whole method of transportation. It's no longer going to be feasible for everybody to drive cars everywhere. And we're now beginning to look at mass transportation, the monorail, the subway systems, all over, and begin to try to figure out how we climb out of that. The automobile is particularly harmful in terms of the waste that it produces, and we're going to have to make them differently. Well, the automobile manufacturers take the point of view that if we have to add on equipment to make our cars' emission problems less dangerous, then what we're going to need to do is to raise the cost of our cars, and they will be less competitive with the foreign cars that are coming in. Well, what we said is that we're going to have the same standards for everybody. And that secondly, we will phase in these requirements so that they will not work an injury to our automobile industry, which is in a very soft position anyway. The number of foreign imports increase every year. They're up to a third of all the cars purchased in the United States. We're not selling very many cars overseas, particularly to Japan or Germany, where many of the foreign cars come from. So this is a huge undertaking, not only in the Clean Air Act, which overwhelmingly passed the Congress and the Senate and is in conference now, but also in revising the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, in which there's been so many scandals. What we're going to be doing now is to organize it so that there is an entirely different situation going on, that we have a Department of Statistics that are separate, in which many of the statistics were cooked. They were manufactured when we were trying to find out what the state of a particular environmental matter was. Frequently, the chemical companies or the industrial companies would bring in their scientists and give us a set of statistics that, quite frankly, were unbelievable. And so we've set up an agency that's going to be free from political influence. We're creating a cabinet level in the and call the Department of Environmental Protection rather than merely an agency, because in most of the other countries in the world, there are in fact world departments. They are at the top of their government. They're not agencies, they're secretaries. And that's what we're doing. And so this is a whole new approach that we're involved in.
Congressman, re-election for an incumbent member to the U.S. House of Representatives is almost a certainty. Some say death is the only real challenger to an incumbent. Are you unbeatable as an incumbent?
No, that's being proved by upsets that are occurring or near defeats. There is validity, of course, in the fact that an incumbency carries with it. One is name recognition. The second is the ability to raise the sums of money that are required to run for these races. And that's why I support, of course, a campaign financing bill that would allow everybody to have equal and same amount of finance resource. We campaign for a shorter period. And I think that it would be fair for all parties concerned. What is happening, though, in terms of the turnover in Congress is that more and more members are staying shorter and shorter periods of time. While they don't get defeated, they normally realize that the time and the obligation, the sacrifice that it's called upon to serve in the House of Representatives or the Senate is just more than they are willing to pay. And so the term of a member is shorter now, even though the member's incumbency is a very large and real hedge against defeat in most cases.
Political pundits allege that Congress's number one public policy is to get reelected. What are your thoughts on that statement?
Well, I think that that's an accurate point of view in that a member can't hardly consider himself going to have his programs put into effect inside of a 1-2-year term. If that is true, then, of course, he's going to have to come back time and time again to accomplish whatever it is that he or she sets out to do legislatively. And so, to an extent, if a person is only going to come in for a term, it's very unlikely that they're going to be able to accomplish anything in terms of their goal.
Are you fearful of slick advertising that skillfully attack an opponent in 30 to 60 second sound bites over the television airwaves?
Well, dirty campaigning, I think, has given a new lease on life through the media and the modern techniques that are available. For example, the Bush use of the Willie Horton ad was probably one of the most unprincipled uses of media that I have seen lately. And, of course, it was debated quite a bit. Now, of course, there are even shorter attacks being made by way of very brief television ads, which released late in a campaign give a person that is being attacked a very small window of opportunity to respond to it. And as a result, we see that that many of these dirty campaign techniques are being used over and over by the same campaign managers that institute them, and that there are now candidates that are going out picking these campaign managers because they know that they have the ability to hit below the belt in terms of political advertising, usually in a way that makes it too late for a person subject to that attack to respond. And I think this is a very deplorable part of the political process. And I'm hoping that the campaign committees and the Fair Election Commission will really begin to seriously intervene, prevent these kinds of ads from going on, and take very severe action against the candidates and the campaign managers that resort to these kinds of techniques.
Do you see this ending anytime soon?
No, I can't tell you that the kind of successful countermeasures are in place that would lead me to feel that it's going to end anytime soon. I wish I could.
The music world lost three giants: Sammy Davis Jr., Dexter Gordon, and Sarah Vaughan. It's widely known that you're a lover of jazz. Reflect briefly on these three giants.
To me, Sarah Vaughan was, of course, a unique jazz contributor. She was a pianist who came out of an era with Dizzy Gillespie and others, in which bebop was developed. And so she had a sort of an instrumental style in terms of her vocal presentations. And she also was a person who had such a gifted voice that it was frequently thought that she could have become a classical singer. Dexter Gordon, of course, was a very unique tenor saxophonist, another modern jazz musician who, again, worked with the Dizzy Gillespie band and the Billy Eckstein bands, which in the 40s and 50s were trailblazers in terms of writing this unique kind of music that requires an ability to improvise so that no presentation is ever really exactly the same. Sammy Davis, of course, is probably the most multi-talented musician as a singer and a dancer and a showman and a musician. He played instruments as well that many people didn't know about. He started off with the Will Davis trio, and went on into the movies in Hollywood, on stage and screen, and of course was considered one of our great all-time artists, all three of whom will be very, very sorely missed.
Today's encore edition of Like It Is featured the late Congressman John Conyers of Detroit. I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.